From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. We're watching two big stories today, Hurricane Sally and the wildfires scorching parts of the West Coast. Those fires are spewing smoke over California, Oregon, and Washington, giving the region some of the unhealthiest air on the planet.
On the Gulf Coast, the problem is water, too much of it. Hurricane Sally made landfall early this morning near Gulf Shores, Alabama, as a Category 2 storm with winds over 96 miles per hour and torrential rain. Dangerous floodwaters are rising in Mississippi, Alabama, and the Florida Panhandle. Earlier today, I spoke with Grover Robinson on a cell phone. He is the mayor of Pensacola, Florida, about 50 miles east of Gulf Shores. I asked him how Sally was affecting his city.
We're trying to get through, obviously, the record amount of rain, and we knew that was one of the challenges that we were going to have. And then, you know, from what the weather said, when the National Weather Service tells you this is going to be historic levels of rain, it really is. It was historic. The good news was for about 15 minutes it quit raining. It's now kind of spitting. It's not really that much of a rain compared to what we've had, but it is back falling a little bit, but it's challenging right now. We put in a significant amount of stormwater infrastructure in 2014 after having some significant flooding from an April storm. But this is probably even top what we've been able to do. It's significant in the amount of flooding we've had, and right now we're still waiting for about the next 2 hours having tidal surge until the tides go back out. We're just trying to hold still and stay on top of it and then get out and assess it. But we still have winds that are over tropical storm force, so we're doing some assessment, but we can't do a big assessment and get our crews and start doing work until we can get the winds down.
Well, and I'm looking at some images, video of Main Street, Pensacola today, and it is just quite stunning to see the water completely flooded on the street, and the water is moving as if the Gulf just is coming right through the streets of town.
Well, that's exactly what happens when you have that kind of storm surge, and the problem is that then backs up and won't let anything that's rain driven back out come out. So at this point, we are until the tides turn around for us, we are we're just trying to get through this and trying to get everybody to higher ground.
Did people evacuate?
Some people certainly evacuated. I don't know what we had in terms of evacuation. Part of the challenge is obviously in COVID, we encourage people, really try to get them not to go to shelters, to try to either find family or friends that are on higher ground that they can go to. We did have 2 days of cycle of high tide, so we did. Yesterday we were very clear with people. I was very clear with people. If you thought it was high today, it's going to be much worse tomorrow. Get out. One of the problems I'm being told by our police officers we're still having is down there where you're talking about seeing people on Main Street. We got people who want to go down there and look at stuff, and they're getting down there and their cars are flooding out. So they're making it more difficult for our police trying to keep people out of there. So we really need everybody just kind of stay home, hunker down and wait till this thing's passed.
And I assume just power outages all over the place today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's going to happen with wind. The wind was not as bad as Ivan was 16 years ago to the day. The wind was not as bad, but clearly the water was much worse. We had between what we had in storm surge and what we're going to have in rain. The 30 inches of rain, 30 inches plus, has just been significant. So we're just trying to get through that and waiting for the tide to go out. Tide goes out, we can lower some of this stuff. We'll begin to lower. Hopefully the wind will begin to recede and we can get some crews out there and get some work starting to get done.
What is your biggest concern right now when you think about all the parts of Pensacola and who might be in the most distress?
Obviously right now dealing with flooding, either low-lying areas or those areas that are coastal. We taking care of all those places is going to be the first thing.
And then from there, it's just the portion of cleanup that goes through afterwards anytime you have a storm like this.
That is Mayor Grover Robinson of Pensacola, Florida. Mayor, thank you for joining us and good luck.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, you take care.
Two Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies are recovering today after someone shot them both at close range in the head over the weekend. The deputies were inside of their patrol car and both are expected to survive. But the shooting is the latest reminder about the dangers of policing, a job our next guest says is it now even more challenging with the rise of nationwide discontent over police conduct. Chuck Wexler is executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum, a group of law enforcement officials and others dedicated to improving the professionalism of policing. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Chuck, it feels like this conversation is erupting into this oversimplified argument where you have Black Lives Matter on one side and Blue Lives Matter on the other. In reality, it's much more complex than that. But what are you hearing from officers about what it's like to be a police right now?
Well, I don't think there's been a more challenging time to be a police officer, you know, for a whole set of reasons. You know, policing is complicated to begin with. And today, if you put on top of that, you know, the tragedy in Minneapolis and the videos that are being seen around the country, there's enormous pressure on police to perform and to respond. And on the other side, you have these two deputies in Los Angeles who are just sitting in a car and someone comes and tries to kill them. So, you know, getting up every morning, putting on your uniform and sort of thinking out loud, what's today going to be like?
Mm-hmm. We know in New York, right now, several city council members from areas like Brooklyn and Queens have said they're getting complaints that police aren't responding to calls. At the same time, they're watching arrest numbers drop off compared to last year. And there's some thinking that this could be part of why we're seeing shooting spike in so many cities right now, because the police are pulling back. Does this assertion sound right to you?
Well, I think it's a lot more complicated than that, but it has been challenging. And I think, you know, it's fair to say the police are far more cautious for all sorts of reasons. If you think about it, if a police officer makes a mistake in making an arrest and it's videotaped, and, you know, they can be held accountable as they should, or they can be disciplined, or they, so people are asking that they be fired. Here's one thing that's happening this year that hasn't happened in 20 years, and that is the demonstrations. Not the demonstrations themselves. The demonstrations have been peaceful. That's not the issue. The issue happens after, say, 10 o'clock at night in a number of cities like Portland, Seattle, Washington, Chicago. A number of cities have experienced a level of violence that the police, quite honestly, weren't prepared for. And some of it has resulted in injuries to police officers and injuries to demonstrators. No one predicted that that would happen. That did not happen in the Ferguson period, except perhaps in St. Louis County. The reform issue comes into that, too, because I think nobody predicted that one of the solutions to the problems with the police would be to defund the police. So it feels different today on many levels.
You know, it just occurred to me, Chuck, that when we're talking about police officers, conduct, safety, we're kind of talking about them as individuals, but they're part of a system. And so I'm just wondering from you, this assertion from many that feel that police are scaling back because of fears really speaks to kind of the disconnect to the larger call for police reform within many of these departments. What is the sentiment from the departments that you're interacting with about whether or not that's a real possibility?
Well, there's some irony here because on the one hand, people are concerned about the police and they want to defund the police. And so defund the police, for example, in New York, in Los Angeles and, say, Seattle means not hiring police. So that means you can't hire, say, police officers who are, many of whom are going to be the most diverse because they're the youngest and you're hiring them. And if you're trying to change the culture, you know, all I can tell you is that we need humane, good police, but we also have to think about the cops themselves, you know, who get up every morning, put on that uniform, and have to deal with some of the most difficult problems in society, risk their lives, risk losing their reputation. So how do we fix this? It's complicated, but it's really important. I'm hopeful that as we have this discussion, good things will come out of it.
That's Chuck Wexler, Executive Director of the Police Executive Research Forum, an organization of law enforcement officials and others dedicated to improving the professionalism of policing. Chuck, thank you for this conversation.
Hey, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
A record number of people are expected to vote by mail this year, so it's very likely we won't know who the winner of the presidential election is on election night. Now, that may sound scary, but it did happen in 2000 when the contest between Al Gore and George W. Bush was too close to call and it all came down to Florida. Florida began that painstaking recount, and it took 36 days before we knew who the next president would be, when the Supreme Court decided to halt the recount, making Bush the winner. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving covered that election and joins us now. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And I know that you covered that election because I was sitting right next to you as an intern in the NPR Election Central there in Washington, D.C. all night long in 2000. And of course, that was just the beginning.
Yes. Oh, my, yes. We thought it would be a long night. We did not know that it would last for 5 weeks.
Exactly. Well, here's a little bit of CNN's coverage through the course of that night. Listen.
A big call to make. CNN announces that we call Florida in the Al Gore column. This is a state both campaigns desperately wanted to win.
Stand by. CNN right now is moving our earlier declaration of Florida back to the too close to call column. At 18 minutes past 2 o'clock Eastern Time, CNN declares that George Walker Bush has won Florida's 25 electoral votes.
You know, Ron, there was just so much confusion going on. Remind us of what happened, especially that night.
That very night, we thought, or initially, that the trend was going to give Florida to Al Gore. He seemed to be ahead in the exit polls. He seemed to be ahead in the early count. And at about 8 o'clock, even before 8 o'clock, the Associated Press called Florida for Al Gore. Now, this was crucial even early in the evening because we were looking at Florida, Pennsylvania, and Michigan as the pivot states in that election. And if Florida, the largest, were to go early for Gore, and actually we thought he was in better shape in Pennsylvania and Michigan, he did end up winning both of those, we thought that might be the ball game. And so when the Associated Press went with Gore for Florida before 8 o'clock, that was huge. And the networks quickly pressed their people to make a prediction. And even though I think most of the folks at those networks were a little wary, and I know at NPR, the guy who was advising us, Andy Kohut, the late Andy Kohut, was saying, way too early, be cautious, Florida's hard to call. And yet most everybody called it, including us. That was clearly premature.
It was premature. And then we went into the recounts in the state of Florida. It was so close. And then the legal battle and all the way to the Supreme Court took over a month. So when people talk about the idea that we wouldn't have a winner on election night, that's not unprecedented. And it wasn't that long ago that we didn't. Was there anything wrong with that in terms of how our democracy is supposed to work?
When the court said stop counting, that gave the electors for Florida to George W. Bush. And when the Electoral College then met shortly before Christmas, which is right on schedule, that gave an official imprimatur to the election. Whatever else you wanted to say, no matter how much you objected, no matter how much you thought it was a miscarriage of justice, the Electoral College did its constitutional job. And then the Senate ratified that when it came back for its new session in January, and that's that. So if it was unsatisfactory and it took a long time, it did follow the book.
So what about the situation we're facing now? There's a lot of concern that basically because so many Democrats are voting by mail, more so than Republicans, that maybe the count on election night could favor Trump, and he'll use that to his advantage. And then maybe later, Biden takes the lead, and President Trump, who's already been saying that there's, the election is rigged and there's going to be fraud in the mail-in votes, that he may say, wait a minute, they're stealing it from me, and people will believe that. What about that?
There's that possibility, Jeremy. If the president chooses to look at a process that is legitimate and that counts the ballots according to each state's laws, and they're different from state to state about when they will count a ballot that was not in hand on election day, if the states follow their laws and the courts uphold that the states did so, then that is the legal result of the election, not what the tally looked like on election night. The tally on election night is always, always unofficial and partial, but it's indicative, and that's what the news organizations go by, what is indicated. Now, the actual legal process of certifying all this, that goes on for weeks and weeks, and the Electoral College, as I said, doesn't meet until just before Christmas. So all the official acts would still have time to happen. The problem we would have would be if one side or the other, and the president is making a lot of noise about this, if one side or the other refused to accept the result. Al Gore could have fought on in 2000. He chose not to. He chose to concede and say, the Supreme Court has ordered an end, and I'm stepping back.
Which brings us to the news media. This is Tom Brokaw anchoring NBC's election night coverage back in 2000.
The votes have been counted, and it's not up to the networks to get them there. The networks tonight, I think that it's fair to say, I think I indicated earlier, we don't just have egg in our face. We've got omelet all over our suits at this point and on our face and everywhere else.
Ron, what do the media need to do this time around to make sure that they don't create a situation where they're acting on incomplete information?
The networks need to make a decision between wanting to be as accurate as history would demand them to be and wanting to be first in saying, we know who won. And what we have had over the years between news organizations, and not just television networks, but between news organizations, we've had a pride of going first, winning the race to be the first to know, the first to report. We have a winner. And the idea of knowing as fast as possible became part of our culture. And of course, you've heard the president say, we have to know on election night, or we don't know on election night, it's not official. Well, of course, we didn't know in the year 2000, and there have been other years as well when it wasn't truly clear. So it really doesn't matter whether you know the first night or the second day or not. What matters is the legal, accurate, and official count, and that might take some time this year.
Ron, let me just ask you one more thing, because after that election in 2000, Al Gore won the popular vote. It was the Electoral College that gave George W. Bush the victory. President Trump, same thing back in 2016. He won the Electoral College but lost the popular vote. Every time that happens, there's a movement to get rid of the Electoral College or at least change it, make it proportional or something like that. We never do that. Do you think that the U.S. will ever get rid of the Electoral College?
Unfortunately, getting rid of the Electoral College has become a partisan issue. For a very long time, there were as many Republicans who thought we ought to as there were Democrats who thought we ought to. But because the two most recent instances of the Electoral College contradicting the popular vote both favored the Republican candidate, you have a lot of Republicans now a little disquieted by the idea of losing the Electoral College. And there has always been a streak of conservative thought that the Electoral College was a good thing to give the states, the entities of the states, as much importance as they were given in the Constitution.
That is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thank you so much as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Smuggling persists during the pandemic. U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers say they continue to seize large loads of drugs on the Texas-Mexico border. The contraband also includes a popular Mexican delicacy. As Angela Cocherga from member station KTEP reports, it's a lot of bologna.
Customers at the La Mejor Texas Meat Shop in El Paso come for
calidad, producto fresco, y precios.
Quality, freshness, and good prices, says market manager Raul Burrell. The classic ranchera music, cuts of beef, and house marinades also provide a taste of Mexico. Medium Ortiz is picking up some steaks and short ribs, but there's one thing this loyal customer cannot buy here or any other store in the U.S., Mexican bologna. The best-known brand is Chimex.
I love that. I love Chimex, you know, but they don't sell it over here, and it's very frustrating because we can't cross it either.
Mexican bologna is not allowed into the U.S. because it's made with pork and could introduce a foreign animal disease. But that does not stop smugglers, says Catherine Vasquez, a U.S. Customs and Border Protection agriculture specialist.
It's loved and they crave it. They smuggle it across because they're able to sell it, per se, under the table.
Vasquez has inspected products at border crossings for more than 20 years. She says Mexican bologna is one of the most popular prohibited items. The contraband comfort food in the form of red-colored rolls turns up time and time again.
They call them chubs, those round rolls.
And the price of a roll at least doubles once it crosses the border, according to Vasquez.
Say anywhere from $30 to $40 all the way up to further north, up to $80 for one single roll.
Since May, CPB officers at border crossings in El Paso have seized at least 1,000 pounds of bologna. One man had 35 10-pound rolls hidden under blankets in the back seat of his SUV.
Have you tasted this bologna yourself? Have you ever tried it?
No. I know that it takes forever to burn.
That's because CPB officers destroy the bologna by incinerating it at ports of entry. And yes, it does smell like a big hot dog roast. Back at the La Mejor Texas Meat Shop, the manager points out the store has some great bologna. But for customer Miriam Ortiz, who grew up eating the Chimex brand in Mexico, it's just not the same.
It doesn't have the same flavor. I don't know if it's because it's Americanized. I don't know if it has the same ingredients. And over there, it's kind of like a reddish color. So I really don't know what's in there, but it's really good.
For Here and Now, I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
Congressional lawmakers released a damning report today blaming Boeing and the Federal Aviation Administration for their roles in the 737 MAX disasters. Democrats on the House Transportation Committee said the two fatal crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia were the horrific culmination of engineering mistakes, mismanagement, and failed oversight. 346 people died in those crashes. Let's bring in here now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, this is the latest report in a series of investigations into these crashes. What's new in this one?
I think what's new, Jeremy, is that here you have Congress saying this, right? If you remember early days, all the finger pointing and questions about who is to blame, it's just another way of codifying that Boeing is at fault here. Perhaps legal ramifications, right? Any hope that Boeing had of saying that it shared blame with many other parties. This is Congress saying no, this American company, according to this American Congress, was at fault here alongside the FAA.
Well, yeah. And on the issue of the FAA, the investigation found that certification of the 737 MAX was compliant with FAA regulations, but it clearly wasn't safe. So how did it get approved?
Well, the FAA relied a lot on Boeing, too much, it seems, on Boeing. It was kind of a arm's length certification process, you might say. Not unusual in industry, but the problem here is the results. We know that, right? And then Boeing, in turn, seems to have relied on overly optimistic assumptions. It thought that things that turned out to be big problems were only little problems. A failure of a sensor, it thought, would not cause a plane crash, even though that would be a problem for pilots to overcome. So the FAA and Boeing together, that bad mix of lack of oversight and rosy assumptions led to those 346 deaths, as you said.
Boeing has suffered financially since these crashes and then, of course, the recession that we're in right now. How is the company responding to this new report?
Well, Boeing today said that it has learned many hard lessons, said that it's already done a lot to fix things. Quote, we made fundamental changes to our company as a result. So this is that continuation of a more humble tone that Boeing has taken, a big contrast with its defiant tone in the first days after the second crash and before the change of its CEO.
We're also hearing from victims' families today, right?
Exactly. And what you would expect, basically. Glad to see this. Glad to see the results of this report. But on the other hand, continued concern and really hoping to hold Boeing accountable, not necessarily convinced that that the changes yet have been made to prevent this from happening in the future. And they kind of see that as the legacy of their relatives preventing future crashes like this.
Seth, do you expect that we will see the 737 MAX carrying passengers again?
Again, yes. Now, if you want to ask me a timeline, Jeremy, please don't go back and play all the old tapes of me and lots of other people around the world who never thought that it would last this long. Hey, I'll take credit for saying it would at least be months in the early days rather than weeks, which some people thought. Nobody thought it would be years. So the easiest thing right now is to say when it won't be. It won't be in the next month or so. But beyond that, who knows how long?
Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Colorado's Secretary of State is now asking the federal government to send out new postcards to voters with the correct information about voting in the state. This comes after Secretary Jenna Griswold filed a lawsuit over the weekend against the U.S. Postal Service for sending out the mailers with what she calls misleading information about Election Day, amounting to voter suppression. Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold, a Democrat, joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
And Secretary Griswold, a lot of people, not just folks in Colorado, have gotten this postcard from the Postal Service, but many still haven't received it. What exactly did it say, and what about it concerns you?
Well, there were two things that were wrong for Colorado voters. The first was the suggestion that Colorado voters need to request an absentee ballot. We send a mail ballot to every registered voter, so there's no need to take that step. And the second thing was about the timeline of when voters need to send back the mail ballot by mail. And the fact is, the timeline was wrong for Colorado, and it could have real disenfranchising effects.
Have any other states joined in this lawsuit or expressed interest in joining?
Well, you know, we were alerted on Thursday from another state that this postcard was going out in their state and received confirmation from the United States Postal Service on Friday and requested the Postal Service not send the postcard. They refused, and so we filed a temporary restraining order late on Friday night. When that was filed, other states asked to see the complaint. I know it's a major concern across the nation. And overall, you know, I just think there's so much misinformation in this election. And my job as Secretary of State is making sure that voters get correct information. So that's the goal of this lawsuit.
And this is a major problem because it's also different depending on where you live, the rules around voting. The Postal Service, however, says the intent was to add clarity to the voting process. Are you questioning its motives? You said this amounts to voter suppression, as I mentioned.
Well, you know, this could have started out as well-intentioned, but unfortunately, when we told the United States Postal Service about the mistake, they planned to just move forward. And it can amount in voter suppression. You know, I recently visited both of Colorado's tribes. I went down to Southwest Colorado to talk with tribal leaders about voting. And in that region of the state, sometimes the mail takes longer than what the Postal Service notice said. And in Colorado, we have to receive the voted ballot back on Election Day. So sending wrong information to voters can disenfranchise them. I would hate to see someone in Southwest Colorado or one of the tribal members follow the USPS's advice and not have their ballot counted.
You're asking that the Postal Service send out new mailers. Why do you feel this is the best way to clear things up for voters? And would that mean the Postal Service actually needs to add the correct details for every state?
Well, we're asking the Postal Service to fund us sending a new mailer. And I do think that, you know, the mailer is good for some states, but there's a lot of states at this point that have adopted vote by mail for all, where they're just sending a ballot to every registered voter. And the United States Postal Service making this mistake of treating the entire country the same when it comes to voting really underlines the need for a national standard for vote by mail, where every registered voter receives a ballot. And like in Colorado, there's early in-person voting, same-day voter registration, and hundreds of ballot drop boxes and voting centers across the state. I think it really highlights the need to end the era of long lines and inconvenience and expect more nationally from elections administration.
What is your next step on this effort?
Well, so we filed the restraining order on Friday. We won the restraining order motion. The United States Postal Service, believe it or not, fought that restraining order and they lost. And now we have a hearing on Friday. You know, it's really important as media and election officials to make sure that voters have access to good information, because confusion or misinformation might just incentivize people not to cast a ballot or participate. In Colorado, every voter will receive a ballot. And once you get that ballot, you can mail it back, vote in person, or drop it off at one of hundreds of drop boxes across the state. And I believe that every American deserves the same right as Coloradans with voting, and everybody should just have access to a mail ballot.
That's Jenna Griswold, Secretary of State for Colorado, speaking with us about her lawsuit against the U.S. Postal Service for mailing out information to voters that she says is not just confusing, but wrong. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, here's one way ballot access has expanded since 2016. Nearly 2 million Americans convicted of felonies have had their voting rights restored since the last presidential election, most of them in the key state of Florida. 2 years ago, voters approved a constitutional amendment granting the right to vote to 1.4 million felons in Florida. But a federal appeals court ruled Friday that the state could withhold that right from anyone who has not paid off outstanding fines and court fees. Desmond Mead is executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, a group that has raised $4 million to pay off the debts of about 4,000 felons so far. And Desmond, what is your reaction to the court's ruling?
You know, my immediate reaction, Tanya, was the fact that I think that democracy took a big blow. Unfortunately, we're now forced to live in a state where a person would have to be forced to choose between putting food on their kids' table or voting, or paying their rent and mortgage or voting. And I don't think that that's what democracy is all about. You know, access to the polls should be unencumbered and free, and there shouldn't be a price tag on it.
What are you hearing from people who have been able to actually pay off their debt about how they were able to do that and how much they had to pay?
Well, you know, the debts, they vary from person to person. I can use myself as an example. You know, when I was under the impression that I had completed everything and I registered to vote in January of 2019. And it wasn't until there was a clemency investigation that it was unearthed that there were about three cases in which I still owed court costs, which totaled to about $1,200. And fortunately, you know, I could afford that $1,200, but that's not the case for many of the 700 plus thousand people who still have outstanding fines and fees.
And those people you're talking about, you actually have been working to register folks that you're calling returning citizens to vote. How are you reaching them and what kind of reception are you getting?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that question. We're trying to utilize influencers, whether they're celebrities or athletes. We've also been doing our own outreach to individuals. But let me tell you a great reaction. We had a young lady, she just found out from her doctor that she had 6 months to live. And as we were registering her, she just started crying. You know, she was saying how for the past 24 years she'd been wanting to vote, but she thought that she would never be able to because she had a felony conviction and she suffered through drug addiction. And as she was signing her name on the dotted line in the voter registration form, She looked up and asked our canvassers to please pray that God would allow her to live long enough to cast her ballot. It's stories like this that really, you know, it angers me to think that a state would try to erect obstacles to prevent American citizens from voting. But at the same time, it also, I guess, strengthens my resolve to make sure that we remain committed to ensuring that every one of the 1.4 million, if they want to have an opportunity to participate in an election, we're going to do everything within our power to make sure that that happens.
Well, researchers estimate that 85,000 felons have already registered to vote. And in its ruling last week, the court said Florida cannot kick people off the rolls without screening those registrations to see if they had any unpaid fines. So far, the state has not done that. So is it your understanding that those people who already registered will actually be able to vote this year?
Oh, yes, it is. And we're going to make sure of that, because just like the state of Florida might be screening, we're going to be screening as well. And if we find individuals that's on the voting rolls already that may have outstanding fines or court costs, we're going to do everything within our power to make sure that those are resolved.
That's Desmond Mead, Executive Director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Desmond, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, what questions do you have about mail-in voting, absentee voting, voting during a pandemic? Let us know at hereandnow.org or tweet us at hereandnow.
We have talked on this show about how growing your own produce has become more popular during the pandemic. Well, with summer officially coming to an end this Tuesday, you might want to preserve some of your harvest. And our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, can help, joins us now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, and I know that you're a big fan of canning, but this year, even more so. Why?
Well, a lot of people start gardening this year for the first time, or they picked it back up because as the pandemic hit, people felt insecure about where their food was going to come from. I have a big garden every year. And, you know, way back when, I was one of these people, too, that thought, why bother canning? It's so much work. Just go to a store and buy tomato sauce or buy some pickles. But mm-hmm. once you grow your own food and you care about where it comes from, canning is just the solution. And it's a whole lot easier than most people think.
Well, and sometimes it's very hard to use all of that produce that's coming out of the garden fast enough. So this is a great way to do it. Now, you have sent me in the good old fashioned mail some jars of food here. You've sent me some beans and carrots that you preserved for me to taste. Are these from your garden?
They are from my garden. Why don't you open that jar up? Right. I call these chili dilly carrots and beans. Dilly beans are a popular pickled item, but I had a load of beautiful carrots this year. So I don't blanch them. Some recipes call for that, but I like when they're crisp and they have a snap. And imagine opening this, you know, in February when there's not that much fresh out of people's gardens. And I just put them into a jar with the carrots and the beans, and I heat up a brine of rice wine vinegar and cider vinegar with some garlic and fresh dill and chili flakes. And I think they're pretty tasty. They'd be delicious with a cheese platter, with sandwiches, just as a really healthy snack.
Well, and I can taste the dill and I can taste the chili there just in that one green bean that I took a bite of just now. Now, how long could you put these after you've opened it up? How long can you keep these?
Because it's in a pickling brine with salt and some sugar and vinegar, they'll keep in your refrigerator for a good 2 weeks. But when you can them, they'll last for a good year. So if you don't want to can and you just want to follow the recipe, you can pop them in your fridge for several weeks and just snack on them. But the thing about canning is that it's extra work, but not a ton.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also sent me some peach jam,
yes.
which these are peaches from your from your orchard or from an orchard in Maine?
No, they're from an orchard near where I live in southern Maine. This was an incredible year for peaches. And it may sound overly simplistic, but the only thing you really need to make great peach jam is great peaches, meaning juicy and ripe. These are mixed with some lemon juice and some sugar, and not a ton of sugar. And hopefully what you're tasting, Jeremy, is just that pure, gorgeous essence of peaches.
Oh, it's absolutely delicious. And we've read that canning can become so popular during the pandemic that some stores are having trouble keeping supplies on the shelves. What are the essentials that you need to have?
Well, this is true. I just got a text from a friend who said canning jars are the new toilet paper. Like, you can't find canning jars in stores. You don't need a lot. You can reuse your jars from last year or jars of store-bought things. What you need are new lids and seals. You need a big pot to put the jars in. You need not much more, some tongs. And what you want to do, though, is you want to be very safe and very attentive and conscious. You want to wash the jars in hot, soapy water. You want to then boil them to sterilize them in a pot of water. And then you're going to fill them up once they dry, leaving about half an inch of head space. And you always want to clean around the rim of the jars so that there's no sauce or pickling juice that leaks out on the edge, because that can promote bacteria, and that's exactly what you want to avoid. Mm-hmm. And then you want to just drop the jars in boiling water for as long as the recipe says. The time starts once the water has come to a boil again. And then, this is really important, this is what scares people. How do I know, will it be safe? What happens is that the jar seals, and when it's done and proper, I'm going to hold the phone up, you hear this dull thud.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes when they're cooling, you'll hear a ping. And now here's a jar that did not seal properly. You see, it's got a buckle, and it's a completely different sound. And then you can remove the outer rim and just try to lift the seal up, and you'll see that it's tight. Once you've got that seal, your food is safe for up to a year.
You know, I have to tell our listeners that almost everybody that we talk to these days is using a special app on their phone that makes it sound like they're in the studio. And you are the best user of that app I've ever heard, that you're able to actually hold that phone next to your ear and make sounds with the can on the side.
Making music for you. Canning music.
You're doing a great job. And by the way, I will say that you also sent some of your tomato sauce, which I am not going to open yet because that is going to make for a delicious meal. But we're going to put all of this at hereandnow.org so people can see it, and more information about canning. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy. Enjoy the food.
I will. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WVUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
The new Eisenhower Memorial in Washington was designed by Frank Gehry, known for his buildings that look like something out of a fantasy. We'll talk with him next time on Here and Now.